From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. James McClintock has spent the last three decades plus in snowsuits and cold water diving gear on the vast ice and in the freezing waters of this planet's great fortress of frozen solitude, the continent of Antarctica. McClintock is a marine biologist. His job has been to study Antarctic life. But more and more, he finds himself watching time accelerate as centuries of change, climate change, have been squeezed into his own lifetime. As the frozen continent in the south melts, this hour on Point, a marine biologist's tales from a lost Antarctica. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your question for our witness to the remaking of Antarctica? Have you been? What did you see? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in the hour, we'll talk about new projections that the great city of Miami will one day be pretty much underwater or on stilts. But first to Antarctica. Here's the sound recorded by researchers there of an iceberg calving from the face of the Mar Ice Piedmont. The knocking you'll hear is tension building in the great mass of ice, followed by the crash of calving when huge ice mass peels off, falls off, and then the wave and ice are heard pushing out into the cove. You can picture the scale. Let's go to Antarctica. It's winter there, of course. James McClintock joins us from summer and Birmingham, Alabama. He's a professor of marine biology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He's been traveling to Antarctica for research since 1982. 14 expeditions. That's a lot. His current work, funded by the National Science Foundation, is focused on the effects of climate change on Antarctica. He wrote a book last year called Lost Antarctica, Adventures in a Disappearing Land, and the E.O. Wilson Foundation has just released a short video based on the book. It's called Ghost Rookeries, narrated by Harrison Ford. To see the video, go to our website, onpointradio.org. James McClintock in Birmingham, Alabama, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
What's taken you back again and again and again and again for so long, James?
Well, when I was a graduate student, I had the good fortune of being invited to Antarctica by my major professor, and I went down and dove into these amazing communities of life under the water. You could see forever, one of the richest marine communities anywhere, and I got the bug. I knew at that time that I wanted to continue with my work in Antarctica, and I've been very fortunate that the National Science Foundation has supported my research program now for well over 20 years, and the rest is history.
We know this is not true, but Antarctica, I think, in a lot of people's minds, can seem almost lifeless. It doesn't have that, of course, penguins, of course, but it doesn't have that polar bear. It seems so cold. I mean, give us a sense of the plentitude of life that you found starting in 1982.
Well, it's just stunning. I mean, there are places in Antarctica when I first was working down there at McMurdo Station where above the ice you see very little life. You're so far south. Occasionally a skua, this bird, flies over your head. But when you drop below the ice and you can see the bottom of the seafloor covered with sponges and soft corals and starfish and sea urchins as far as you can see, you realize that this is an incredibly rich system that's being fed by nutrient-rich water and is a treasure. Now, on the Antarctic Peninsula, where I've been working the last 12 to 15 years...
This is the peninsula that veers up toward the tip of South America there.
Correct. It's quite large. It's about 1,000 miles in length, and the life is everywhere. You don't have to go underwater. You see penguins swimming through the water. You see seals, fur seals, leopard seals, elephant seals everywhere, whales. It's a tremendous, tremendous diversity of life.
There is an astonishing description in here of you out with the crew preparing to dive. You go through all the work out at the water's edge on the ice to get your diving suits on. And just as you're about to go in, a leopard seal shows up. I had never read such a vivid description of, I didn't even know what a leopard seal was. You describe it as almost like a huge snake, 8 feet plus, huge mouth, snake-like, rather than that kind of pudgy, friendly-looking seal. Describe what it looked like and what happened that day as you tried to avoid it.
Well, it was an amazing day. As you said, we were out on the ice edge ready to dive, and my dive buddy, Ron, was getting into his, he's all suited up, sitting on the ice. And we had seen this leopard seal earlier in the day, a few hours earlier, and just came up, and it was my first view of a leopard seal, opened its mouth filled with teeth, and it's got a very serpentine-like look to it with its beady eyes.
And just to make it clear, to avoid getting in the water with it, you then took your suits back off and trekked an hour and a half across the ice.
That's correct. We'd been told, don't dive if you see them, so we went down the coast. The leopard seal had disappeared, or so we thought. And just before Ron went in, he was literally reaching for his mask, you know, 30 seconds from going into the water. The leopard seal came right up between his legs and just stared him right in the face. And Ron did a 2.5 back gainer with 150 pounds of scuba gear on. And I actually was able to snap a picture of this and catch the leopard seal right there where Ron had been sitting. They are remarkable animals, beautiful animals, but they're also an animal that you have to respect when you're diving in Antarctica.
You're right. One must see a leopard seal to fully appreciate it, unlike the roly-poly fur seal pups or the humorously grotesque elephant seals. James McClintock writes, leopard seals appear quite reptilian, almost snake-like, with yellow tiger-slit eyes and seemingly devilish grins punctuated with menacing teeth. This seal thrust its chest up against the ice edge in front of us and leered. You walked an hour and a half, and it showed up again. You surmise that, as it might do with some other prey, it followed you from underneath the ice as you trekked over it.
Yes, I think there's no question that the whole time we were hiking along the ice edge, it was under us. And this is what they do when they attack penguins or seals. They wait under the ice until the unsuspecting animal leaps in. In this case, I think the leopard seal was curious about us and wasn't going to attack per se. But we did not test that hypothesis.
Krill and the small life, what do you call them, butterflies, the sea butterflies of the Antarctic region. Describe them and their volume for us.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, if you look at these sea butterflies, there's two types. There's those that have shells and those that don't. But they're extremely abundant. They occur as abundant as the stars in the sky, by the trillions in the water in Antarctica and other seas too. But in Antarctica, what's happening is the climate is warming and the sea is warming. There's actually some transitions occurring in terms of these small organisms, both those that are plants and animals that make up what we call the plankton.
And those are not exactly good changes for this huge volume of sea butterflies. Those shells, not through warming, but through associated acidification, are being worn away?
That's correct. We have a grant right now from the National Science Foundation looking at ocean acidification in Antarctica. And there was a recent discovery that just stunned me. They actually have sampled populations of these shelled butterflies, sea butterflies, and under a microscope today, you don't have to put them in acidic conditions and look at down the road. Today, the shells are already beginning to show signs of dissolving. And this is very concerning because ocean acidification is related to the oceans taking up carbon dioxide that we're putting up in the air through anthropogenic sources. And this is concerning to all marine biologists that the sea is becoming more and more acidic. It's 30% more acidic now than it was at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
This related to CO2, like warming itself. You describe other weird changes over this time. Among them, the southward march of the king crab, for the first time, as far as we know, getting a foothold in the Arctic. What's going on there, James?
Well, what's happening with king crabs is that while they have occurred for a long time in the very deep seas that surround Antarctica, we suspect that they may be moving up the Antarctic slope and towards the shelf of Antarctica, that this is the body of land below the sea that surrounds Antarctica. And there have never been crushing predators before in these areas of Antarctica. There's no crabs, there's no lobsters, the fish have weak jaws. So if I was to hand somebody an Antarctic clam, they could crush it with their two fingers. The shells are very thin and poorly defended. So we're worried that these king crabs, should they move up into this ecosystem, could in fact decimate or alter these ecosystems tremendously. Now you might ask, well, who would care? But we know from the research we've done in Antarctica in chemical ecology, looking at toxic compounds that could be potentially drugs to fight cancer and AIDS and cystic fibrosis and different diseases, that there are, this is a repository of millions of years of evolutionary kinds of adaptations to defend themselves chemically, and we found compounds active against melanoma skin cancer, against H1N1 flu viruses. So my point is that this invasion or this range extension of king crabs could have a profound influence on this community and its resources.
And there are bigger worries. Antarctica, the continent, contains 61% of all the fresh water on Earth. If it were to melt, global sea levels, James McClintock reminds us, would rise an estimated 200 feet, say goodbye to coastlines everywhere. He doesn't see that happening, but just a fraction of that, and we've got problems. And he has seen that fraction. He writes about all of this in his book, Lost Antarctica, Adventures in a Disappearing Land. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about a life in Antarctica with a witness to climate change. James McClintock joins us. He is a professor of marine biology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He's been doing work in Antarctica for research since 1982, expedition after expedition. You'd be hard-pressed to find someone who has done more, spent more time on the ice, under the ice, looking at the life and conditions there than James McClintock. He's written about it in a book called Lost Antarctica, Adventures in a Disappearing Land. Here's a little sound of the Adelie penguin of Antarctica in what biologists call ecstatic display. This is near Palmer Station on the Antarctic Peninsula, where James McClintock has spent a lot of time. Ecstatic display. You can try that in the shower. Here's the sound of Adelie penguin chicks recorded in Antarctica. But they're vulnerable. Here's a little bit of Harrison Ford narrating a short video funded by the E.O. Wilson Foundation called Ghost Rookeries, as in abandoned. It tells the story of the Adelie penguin now dying off because of new late-season snowstorms that come with climate change, first burying the mothers as they sit on their eggs, then drowning the eggs when the snow turns to ice water.
As the Antarctic Peninsular air has warmed, its sub-freezing air has become increasingly humid, facilitating unseasonably late snowstorms.
And more from Harrison Ford.
If the climate warms in Antarctica and the sea ice retreats, there's nowhere else for the Adelie penguin to call home. But the climate is getting warmer.
James McClintock, you know the warming and the penguin, the Adelie. Let's start with the Adelie. When did you first see them? And what have you seen happen with their populations?
Well, I've seen Adelie penguins, ever since I first went to McMurdo Station in 1987. But the population of Adelie penguins near Palmer Station on the Antarctic Peninsula, where I've been working the past 12 years or so, this is a population that's experiencing tremendous change. One of the world's leading experts on the Adelie penguin, Bill Fraser, has been following the populations near Palmer Station for 35 years, ever since he was a grad student. And the population has just dropped from 15,000 breeding pairs down to about 1,500 over that period of time. So it's very concerning. And Bill thinks the reason that the penguins are really experiencing these dramatic declines has to do with the piece that Harrison Ford just read to us or narrated from the E.O. Wilson Biodiversity Foundation piece. And that's the unseasonable snowstorms that are occurring in burying the eggs, they're drowning. The other thing is that they depend on the annual sea ice very much as a platform to get offshore and out to the rich krill feeding grounds where they feed on these shrimp-like krill. And in the past 30 years, it's hard to believe, but 40% of the annual sea ice along the western Antarctic Peninsula has vanished, both in terms of its duration in time and distance offshore.
40%? So now, I mean, we hear a lot about 40%. The Arctic, the polar cap in the north, but here you're talking big retreat in the south.
Yes, it's just amazing. And so the Adelie now has to swim much further offshore to get to its food. They're living on a very tight energy budget. And Bill Fraser suspects that this is another reason why the Adelie is vanishing from this region.
You write about the very experience of the ice kind of breaking away and how back in the day when you were first coming to Antarctica, when the boom of a calving glacier suddenly took up, everybody would rush outside to watch it, but that it's become so common that it's mundane now, that people don't even get up from their laptops anymore.
Nope. You just sit there, and every day now, 3-4 times, I'll hear a big crash, you know, during the late austral summer. And it used to be such an amazing event. You'd run down the hall and throw open the door and look out into Arthur Harbor and watch the waves come down. And now it's just part of life. And, you know, we've become used to hearing the glaciers calve. And this is indicative of what's happening up and down the peninsula. 87% of the glaciers on the peninsula are in retreat. And we're talking about a very significant rate of retreat.
This is Antarctica, the sound of Antarctica's ice peeling away when you hear that, all that calving going on. It used to be, you write, maybe once or twice a week.
Correct. Yeah. Now it's 2-3 times a day. And, you know, it's not just the glaciers that are changing. The ice sheets that are connected to land that are hundreds of feet thick are breaking out. We've had, you know, the Larsen B ice shelf broke out with...
famous sort of Rhode Island-sized chunk that took off.
Absolutely. And more recently, the Wilkins ice shelf is in threat of breaking out, something the size of Connecticut. So these are massive events that are changing the ice features, particularly around the peninsula and now more so on the western Antarctic part of the continent. So these are major events that I never dreamed I would see happening in my lifetime.
It's only 30 years you've been there, but, you know, so much change in such a small amount of time. Why are these changes, these drastic, dramatic changes in Antarctica happening?
Well, clearly it's warming, and we're very fortunate that 20 miles from where I work at Palmer Station, a former British station, now Ukrainian, they've been recording air temperatures for the past 60 years daily. And we know that over that 60-year period, if you look at the air temperatures during the winter, they've increased 10 degrees Fahrenheit over that period of time, which really sets this Antarctic Peninsula at a scale of warming that may even exceed the Arctic, which everybody's very familiar with. So as the air temperatures warm, there's obvious impacts on the ice features, and many of the marine organisms are being impacted as well. The other thing is the Antarctic Circumpolar Current, which is the world's largest current, which surrounds Antarctica and goes in a clockwise direction, is warming. And as a result of that, it tends to surface to come up from deeper water and go right along the Antarctic Peninsula. And that's thought to be also contributing to the warming that's occurring. So there's a number of reasons why warming is so profound on the peninsula. And now also, as I said, on the western part of the continent.
For a long time, that great current, which goes all the way around this southern continent, helped keep Antarctica cold.
It did. Essentially put it into a deep freeze, and the organisms that could adapt did, and those that couldn't went away. And this is one of the reasons why certain groups of organisms like sharks and crabs and things like this may never have made it in Antarctica. And as it's warming, the doors are being opened to them, these types of organisms. So yes, it is a deep freeze, but it's not, obviously, with the recent warming, it's not impenetrable.
The warming. You know the debate that's gone on for decades. It seems to be quite decided and over among the overwhelming population of scientists. But why the warming?
Well, the warming is the effect of essentially the greenhouse gases that we're putting up into the atmosphere. And I've lectured on climate change now for well over 10 years. And there doesn't seem to be any doubt now that carbon dioxide is a potent greenhouse gas. And that, in fact, I get very few questions now from my audiences questioning whether it's warming. There seems to be a general acceptance that the planet is warming. The question has turned to, do we as humans have a role in that warming, or perhaps it's just some sort of a natural perturbation that will go away eventually. So yes, I mean, this is something that more and more so people seem to be accepting that climate change is occurring and becoming more concerned about what we should do about it.
That question, of course, is what it's all about. I mean, if it's just nature doing its thing, that's one thing. If it's our CO2, then we have some hand in this and maybe some capacity to minimize the damage. How do you answer? You write about going to Rotary clubs and around. When that question comes up, asking if we have a role or the role in this climate change, what do you, Mr. Scientist, say?
Well, it's interesting because I do address the issue of climate change in my presentations to Rotary and Sierra Club and whatever different organization it is. And I love to break the ice because it is sort of a political issue. And I put up one of my favorite sort of cartoons from the web about global warming, which shows a clothesline. And on the clothesline are women's undergarments dating from the 1700s up to the present. And, of course, they get smaller and smaller. And everybody gets – and it says across the top, you know, the reason for global warming or proof positive of global warming. And everybody chuckles. And then I'm very objective in my presentations. I don't take sides, but I say what convinced me about our role in climate change is the following graph. And I put up a graph showing the data from the ice core through the Antarctic ice sheet that went down about 3,600 meters. And it's a history of our Earth's atmosphere that are trapped in these little air bubbles in that ice core. And if you look back over the past million years, you never see levels of carbon dioxide above about 300 parts per million. And then you look over on the far right-hand part of the graph, and when you hit to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of carbon dioxide just shoots up, and now about 25% higher than it's ever been over a million years. And this is what I tell my audience convinced me that this is very much something that we have a role in contributing to.
Simple and plain and straightforward is that. So there we are. And what do we do about it? How much further melting, destruction of the biota in Antarctica is baked in the cake already? If we would put the brakes on, you know, where are we headed? If 61% of fresh water is down there and a bunch of it's already sort of destined to melt as a result of all this, what's still on the table to be done?
That's a good question. I mean, I think what you're seeing now is that there's the scientists, climate scientists, glaciologists have brought Antarctica into the picture in terms of global sea level rise, just as they have Greenland, and they're contributing factors. I don't see this massive ice sheet that sits on top of Antarctica melting, but there are certainly these ice sheets, as they break out around the Antarctic Peninsula, serve as barriers for land-based glaciers that are flowing seaward. And as that ice does enter the ocean, it contributes to sea level rise. How much of this is already destined for the future is hard to predict, but I don't think that there's any question that these warning signs indicate that we need to get on the ball and begin to consider ways of mitigating what's happening.
James McClintock, marine biologist, is author of Lost Antarctica, Adventures in a Disappearing Land, written out of his 30-plus years of experience there. He joins us from Birmingham, Alabama. Joe's calling from Wethersfield, Connecticut. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air with James McClintock.
Hi, Tom. Hi, James. I'm very interested in your show. I had spent two very interesting years in Antarctica as a U.S. Navy photographer. I was stationed at McMurdo, but I flew all across the continent at the South Pole Station, and one time I went over to Halley Bay, the British base, way on the East Coast. I never made it to Palmer, but while I was down there, I was there in Operation Deep Freeze 71 and 72 for a 5-month period, October through February, of those two seasons. And it was really only one day because, of course, the sun never set for that period of time.
Right.
But we supported the United States Antarctic Research Program scientists. That was the only way they could really get around the continent. And I was fortunate enough to cover them photographically for the Navy and for the NSF, the National Science Foundation.
Great.
It was a great period of life to enjoy. I keep up with Antarctica because you'll never forget it once you've been there. There's no place like it that I know of on the face of the earth.
Absolutely.
I am concerned about what I have been reading lately, and maybe James can go into it a little bit more, about these underground lakes under the ice cap. And when I was there, the only lakes that I remember were Lake Vanda and in the dry valleys. And I'm a couple questions. One is, do you know if the dry valleys have extended their reach? And do you also know if the precipitation of Antarctica, which is basically a desert, even though it's frozen, is it still around 2 inches per year?
Joe, thank you so much for that blast from the past there. It sounds like an amazing experience. A lot changed since the 70s. What about it, James?
Yeah, Joe, first of all, let me thank you for your logistical support of science in Antarctica. It's so important for scientists down there to have that. Wouldn't be possible without you. And then I would say that the dry valleys are beginning to show some signs of impacts of climate change. I've read some recent articles about that. I wouldn't say that the precipitation levels in the dry valleys per se or around McMurdo have changed dramatically. But the area where I'm working near Palmer Station, there's no question that there's much more snowfall, more rain coming down, as well as it's warming on the peninsula. So it is becoming a moister, wetter environment on the peninsula. I don't think that's true of the dry valleys, at least so far. But you do see some impacts of climate change in the dry valleys in terms of some of the microbial organisms living there.
And I'm reading here from a recent issue of Science, they're talking about melting from underneath, driven by warm ocean waters, accounting for maybe more than half of shelf lost from 03 to 08. What about that in the lakes question?
Yeah, well, the Pine Island Glacier is what you're referring to, Tom, and that's an area in the western Antarctic where there is the circumpolar current coming up underneath the glacier there and melting the underside of it. I mean, we're talking about just tremendous melting, and there's some concern about that because the entire western Antarctic ice sheet sort of flows down through that area towards the ocean, and some sense that if it breaks out that this could accelerate that flowing rate. As far as the deep water lakes or the underground lakes, I should say, in Antarctica, and Joe's questions about that, these lakes have been here for a very long time. They're not being impacted by climate change. The big issue about these deep lakes is our entering them. And just recently, after quite a bit of controversy and back and forth, scientists have decided it's okay to get the drill bit down into one of these lakes, sample the water, and they're discovering, perhaps not surprisingly, but that there is life in these lakes. And it's much like going to another solar system and finding life on another planet. It's so
amazing.
Remote.
Amazing.
But it is there.
James, what are the, stakes for the rest of the world of melt and change in Antarctica?
Well, first and foremost, of course, it's considered that the melt from Antarctica is going to contribute to some degree to sea level rise. So there's that. And then, as I pointed out, it's a tremendous, the biodiversity of marine life there is stunning. And here hold perhaps cures to cancer and AIDS and cystic fibrosis and other diseases.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a life in Antarctica with a witness to climate change there over decades. Dramatic change in the ecosystem, the ice, the climate of the great continent at the southern end of the world. James McClintock is with us from Birmingham, Alabama, marine biologist, author of Lost Antarctica. We're going to turn to Miami and what sea level rise, change, could mean there in this century in a moment. But let's stick with Antarctica and the very dramatic story there for a moment. Incredible photographs in this book, among other things, of the stunning mountains on the Antarctic Peninsula where James McClintock has spent so much time on Wilhelmina Bay there. Just amazing. Bill in Elkhart, Illinois is calling. Bill, you're on the air with James McClintock.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question was regarding methane hydrates, and I would like your expert to explain what those are to the callers, because the screener seemed not quite sure what I was talking about. And I read a scientific paper about 3 months ago that seemed to indicate that methane hydrate release may have begun to be triggered in the Antarctic. I would like to know if your guest has seen any evidence of methane release down there and what that might imply, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Bill, we'll do it straight away. James McClintock, methane hydrates. What do we got here and what have you seen?
Yeah, well, we know that methane is a potent greenhouse gas, even more so than CO2. Now, I'm not an expert in this area, Bill, and I'm not aware of any evidence to support that these are beginning to be released in Antarctica. It may be so. It's not an area that I'm familiar with. There is a lot of concern, of course, as you know, Bill, about the Arctic and the release of methane as the tundra begins to warm, and a big concern as well in some of the ocean floor areas of the Arctic and potentially Antarctica as well, that as the sea warms, we could have a release of methane increased from the seafloor.
You do write about the scouring of the seafloor around Antarctica as more and more ice breaks away. It's sort of like great bulldozers dragging across that seafloor and taking a lot of life away with it.
That's right. You can, when you see, I've been taking groups down to Antarctica now for 6 years on these fighting climate change cruises for Abercrombie and Kent in December and soon to the Arctic as well. And one of the things as we're going along the coast in the ship is we will see these calving events occur, and you can actually see these icebergs sort of rolling over or grounded into the ground, you know, crushing along. And if you put on a scuba outfit and get in the water and go down and look at the bottom, what you see is that these things are carving away the bottom of the ocean. And there's some concern that as climate change increases the number of calvings and icebergs in the area, that we're going to have an impact, a scouring, if you will, of these seafloor communities, another stress on these seafloor communities.
I mean, the range of impacts is kind of incredible as I read through your book, just one after another with all kinds of consequences. Eric in Endeavor, Wisconsin, you're on with James McClintock. Eric, thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom. James.
Hi.
Yeah, I was kind of curious if you knew my brother-in-law, Peter Doran, of the University of Illinois, and familiar with his work down there. He was working on a 36-meter hole and taking core samples and diving in the underground lakes to look
at it. Yes, Eric, I know the name. I don't know Peter personally, but I have heard of him, and I'm familiar with the folks that do dive in these lakes. My hat is off to them. I dive through 7 or 8 feet of sea ice to get into the ocean, and they're diving through many, many more meters of ice. It's a little scary, but wow, what neat stuff they're doing.
Eric, what do you make of James and maybe your brother's reports on man-made climate change and its impacts? What do you think, Eric?
Well, actually, I was raised in a home where we were taught that climate change is not man-made. It's just a political conspiracy. And you should have seen the look on Peter's face when me and my sister explained to him that, you know, to believe that, you'd have to expect, that every scientist for the last 300 years is involved in some conspiracy to disprove creation.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely believe that climate change is man-made at this point.
Eric, I appreciate your call. You know, James, I know that you've been thinking lately about, even at this relatively late date, we still have a lot of denial going on. And you've been thinking about the moral culpability of climate change deniers at this point.
Yeah, the general public gets information from a variety of sources, and they make up their own mind based on where they go. I think my concern is more among the scientific community where... there are some individuals that still seem to be very adamant that this may be something that's not happening, or, you know, the models are just not strong enough, and there's this doubt and that doubt. And I think it's, you know, despite it getting harder and harder for the media to find a contrarian in this argument. So I just wonder how these individuals, what their motive is. Some of them may actually believe what they're saying. Others may be motivated to for the limelight, perhaps, or there may be interest in other interests, I should say, that are behind their stand.
You also write fairly critically about the media. You're saying it's time to stop, you know, sort of putting both views on as though they have some kind of equal weight. You say, cut it out.
Yeah, I don't blame the media for wanting to have both opinions put forth. But when you have a scientist sitting there in one chair facing another one, and one represents, you know, 99.9% of all scientists, and the other represents the 0.1%, when they're in front of the camera or they're on the radio, they sound like they're on equal footing. And I worry a little bit about the skewedness that provides. I don't have a good answer to that because I believe very strongly that everybody's entitled to their opinion. I guess maybe the kind of thing that you just did, Tom, where you pointed out that, you know, 99.x% of scientists have decided climate change is something real and something to be dealt with, that helps the listener understand that it's not an argument that's on equal footing between scientists.
Jeff in Oklahoma City. Jeff, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just had a quick question to kind of help put it in perspective that I've kind of always wondered about. We talked about you know, the level of the sea and the changes, you know, possible 200-foot sea level changes. What does that mean for us? I mean, if there's a 100-foot rise in the level of the sea, does that mean we just lose, you know, just Miami, or does that mean we're going to lose the entire Florida Peninsula, or how does that equate to loss of land mass?
I mean, in fairness, the 200, James points out, would be if all of Antarctica melted. He says he doesn't see that happening, not even 100, but a whole lot less than that would have very large impacts. Is it not so, James?
No, you're absolutely right. Jeff, it's not a matter of hundreds of feet. It's a matter of several feet. We're talking about, you know, a couple of meters, something along those lines. But what you have to realize is that a very small increase in sea level rise has huge impacts for coastal communities. So this is something that's coming up with our next guest, is that, you know, these cities that are sitting there at sea level are already experiencing more problems when we have hurricanes. And so Antarctica is going to be a contributor to this scenario. Will it be contributing a meter, half a meter, whatever? You throw in Greenland and the warming of the ocean itself expands the water, and that contributes to sea level rise. So these are serious things, but don't panic. We're not going to have a 200-foot increase in sea level rise anytime soon.
Though plenty to worry about with just a few feet. One more call. Stacy in Boston. Stacy, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. My understanding is that the health of our oceans is one of the preeminent issues in the environment today. And I just wanted to press the point with James. I wanted to know what he thinks we need at this point in terms of money, public policy, public awareness, in trying to turn this situation around.
I'm so glad for that. James.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great point, Stacey. I think that there's no question that the oceans are suffering from pollution, from climate change, from ocean acidification, from many different directions, overfishing. I'm all for supporting these environmental groups that are putting their muscle into raising money to help support the research that needs to be done and putting mitigation policies into place, as well as, you know, supporting your government officials that are behind us protecting our environment and biodiversity.
I mean, isn't CO2 the issue? Don't we have to back off of what we're putting into the atmosphere?
We do. We have to back off the amount of CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere. We have to begin to look at other strategies.
We've looked at it today from the south up, as far south as you can go, Antarctica. James McClintock's book is Lost Antarctica, Adventures in a Disappearing Land. James, you make it very real to us, magnificent and deeply concerning at the same time. We're grateful for all of your work and your time today.
My pleasure.
In a moment, we go to a Miami of the future, and it's underwater, or remade. This is On Point. If you've been meaning to visit Miami, don't wait forever. Projections now say that by the end of this century, its streets may look like Venice. Jeff Goodell is contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine. His big article about the future of that city on a warming planet is called Goodbye Miami, and it appears in the current issue of the magazine. You can find the article at our website, onpointradio.org. Jeff joins me now from Saratoga, New York. Jeff, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You are quoting here Harold Wanless, the chairman of the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Miami, saying, "Miami, as we know it today, is doomed. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when." What's that future look like, Jeff?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, one of the issues is there's something, you know, sea level rise is not a hypothetical thing, as James McClintock was just talking about. And Miami is a particularly low-lying city, particularly difficult to protect against sea level rise, unlike other cities, even New Orleans. And so it's pretty easy to see what happens here, how this plays out in the future, and whether or not Miami is going to sort of survive in the 21st century is really a big question, and it's going to require a complete rethinking of what that city means.
For the next 20 years, you write, Jeff, the Miami Beach plan is to try to escape inundation with a huge network of pumps around the city. That would do what? How would that work?
Well, they're trying to deal with even flooding from storm surges and from big rainfall events. You know, Miami, one of the big problems with the whole region is that it's very flat and low-lying. So already high tides are starting to come in through the storm drainage system and flood the streets of Miami. So what they need to do now is pump that out and have a system of pumping stations around the Miami Beach area that can essentially get rid of the water when it comes in. And that strategy will work fine for the next decade, perhaps, or two. But when you start looking at it beyond that, it's hard to see how you're going to keep pumping the ocean out to the degree that they're going to have to in the future.
I mean, already, where do you pump it to so it doesn't just slosh right back in?
Well, that's right. And, you know, some of these storm drain systems have a kind of valve on them that they can close when the tides are high to keep the water from coming in through the storm drain system. But that really is the problem in the long term. And Miami has another big problem, which is that the foundation that the city is built upon is limestone, and that limestone is quite porous. So even if you try to build seawalls around the city in the way that, say, a lot of people are familiar with what they've done in the Netherlands, that's not going to work because the water will go around and through the limestone and come up in the city anyway.
What kind of solutions are people talking about, or is there a solution to the eventual impact of ocean rise?
Well, one of the big problems is that people aren't talking about even potential solutions. Florida is very much in deep denial about the consequences of this. And so there really is not a lot of thinking about it. Unlike, say, London, which is also a very vulnerable city in different ways, they've been doing a lot of thinking about it and have a lot of plans for what London will look like in, say, 2100. Nothing of that sort has been going on in Florida. I talked to a lot of Dutch engineering experts and things, and, you know, it's really hard to imagine how it will be protected. I think that, you know, ultimately it's going to have to figure out ways to live with the water. In other words, to kind of elevate the city. And I don't have to explain what a massive engineering project that would be.
To try and put a city the size of Miami up on stilts, I mean, you say there's a lot, the glaciologists and others you talk to say so much is baked in the system already. The Everglades National Park, a goner already. And, you know, depending on how much, with just 3 feet of sea level rise, a third of southern Florida will vanish, they tell you. At 6 feet, more than half gone. 12 feet, you know, big number, but it would just be kind of an isolated archipelago. What? How much of the city could be saved in, let's just say, a 3 foot rise scenario?
Well, in a 3 foot rise scenario, you know, it's not just about, you know, what parts get flooded. It's about, you know, the problems of the water seeping into the drinking water supply for Miami. It's about problems with the roads being inundated, power systems. You have big nuclear plants there that are vulnerable to sea level rise. It gets to be a very complicated situation. And, you know, there's ways of dealing with it. Things like relocating now out of areas that are particularly vulnerable, thinking ahead about how you build buildings, elevating the key infrastructure in the building so that they're less vulnerable, reducing subsidies for coastal buildings, things like that. But, you know, Miami's been, for basically the entire time it's been a city, for the last 100 years, it's been all about, you know, headlong development along the beaches, and there hasn't been a lot of thinking about the future and how it might protect itself from things like this. So it really needs to essentially reinvent itself as a place.
You write that the State House in Tallahassee is a monument to climate change denial, and that there's a kind of unstated view that if it gets bad enough, the federal government will one way or another come in and bail everybody out. Is that possible?
No. I think that, you know, right now in Florida, it is sort of dominated by Tea Party politics, the idea that we don't need the government in our lives. Of course, one of the ironies of that is that in order to begin to deal with this, it really does need political leadership. It needs a sense of making decisions about how one will adapt, about how we will build infrastructure, what kind of infrastructure needs to be rebuilt. All of Florida has a big problem with property insurance also, which is going to become an even bigger problem in the future. It's getting very, very expensive, and a lot of private insurers are pulling out of there. So there's questions about what degree the government is going to subsidize property insurance and flood insurance. And there's a lot of big strategic thinking that has to go on, and it can't go on when you're in denial about what kind of future you're facing.
Let's get it going. We love Miami. Bring on the stilts. Bring on the thinking. Jeff Goodell's piece in Rolling Stone is Goodbye, Miami. Thanks, Jeff. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.